The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Hi, it's Patrick Cox here, and in today's podcast, and in the next three, we're visiting some of the places in Britain that played a role, large or small, in the evolution of the English language. We start at the beginning, or near it. Here's my report. Dialects are fading away in Britain, but they haven't disappeared yet. Far from it. One of the best known and least penetrable to outsiders is the Geordie accent, spoken in Newcastle and other parts of northeast England.
If that's the worst thing he's ever done in his career, took a chicken sandwich out of his room when he was with the England camp, and then who knows, there wouldn't be even sleeping tablets in that camp, that's for sure.
See what I mean? Much of the region where this dialect is spoken is a post-industrial place today. Shipbuilding, coal mining, they're gone, replaced by call centres, office parks and a container ship port. Something else too.
On this site we've got pigs and sheep and goats, cattle.
And ducks. All kinds of farmyard animals, including some ancient varieties, more popular 1,400 years ago than they are now, like this shaggy-haired pig.
Yeah, that is actually half a ton of very, very grumpy animal, and it's only interested if you, A, if you're going to feed it, and B, if you fall in which case you are food.
Point taken. Thank you, John Sadler. Sadler is the living history coordinator of this place. It's called Bede's World. The animals are part of a recreation of an Anglo-Saxon village. There are timber-framed buildings here, part of a farm called Yearway. That's Old English. Next door is a monastery that really is old. It was the home of a monk known as the Venerable Bede.
He's famous as a writer and as a teacher. And of course, he has this keen interest in history and in language.
Bede wrote an ecclesiastical history of the nation at the time. We're talking 7th century here.
Taking up the story now is linguist David Crystal.
And he's the first person to actually write down who it was that actually came to the British Isles. He talks about the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes and discusses the range of languages that are spoken around the country.
These were the languages that arrived in Britain after the Romans had left. The newcomers, these Angles, Saxons and Jutes, they found themselves in a place already heaving with languages, Celtic ones, as well as bits and pieces of languages left behind by Roman mercenaries who came from all over the empire, which explains why English, from its very beginnings, was a mongrel tongue, a Frisian word here, a Latin one there, and so on. Pure English? It never existed. Now, these waves of migrants, they also help form the dialects that you can still hear in Britain. On average, there's a different one for every 25 miles you travel.
It all goes back to those original days when the people from Denmark, as it were, settled in one part of the country. The people from another part of Northern Europe settled somewhere else. You only have to settle on the other side of a river, on the other side of a mountain range. And before you know it, you know, within a few years, you're starting to speak in a slightly different way. And after 100 years, a very different way from what it was before.
This is one of the reasons Bede's writings are so valuable. They've helped linguists trace the origins of today's dialects. Of course, the migration didn't stop there. Vikings, Normans, and much later, Irish, Jamaican, Indians, and others, they've all left their stamp on Britain's dialects.
Morning, gentlemen. Morning.
Morning, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Morning.
We're inside Bede's church now, the bit of it that dates back to the 7th century. John Sadler shows me his favourite thing here.
And it is said that this chair here is Bede's chair.
Tell me why you laughed at that.
Because it's actually impossible to say whether it is original or whether it might be a subsequent copy.
It looks old enough, and if it is a copy, it seems fitting. The monk who may or may not have sat on it was documenting a language that itself copied and borrowed and stole from other languages. English, like the people who spoke it then and speak it today, is a fabulous hodgepodge. For the World, I'm Patrick Cox. So about 250 years after Bede died, someone, we don't know who, wrote the epic poem Beowulf, the masterpiece of Old English. There have been many translations over the years, and a new one has just come out. Well, I say new. It's actually nearly 100 years old. The translator is J.R.R. Tolkien, better known, of course, for inventing the Elvish languages for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Well, this translation is finally seeing the light of day, and one guy who's been pretty impatient to get his hands on a copy is Andy Orchard. He's the Rawlinson and Bosworth Professor of Anglo-Saxon at Pembroke College, Oxford. The BBC's Sarah Montague ask the questions about what Tolkien's translation is like, including this key question.
Is it any good?
It's excellent. It's very Tolkienian, I'd put it like that. I think people who are used to the cadences of Tolkien's prose will not be disappointed. And those of us who find his poetry slightly cringe-making will be pleased that he didn't put it completely into verse.
But I suppose also the creator of Middle-earth is the right person to take a look at the sort of monsters of earlier, of 1,000 years before.
Well, Tolkien was a great Anglo-Saxon scholar. He produced this translation in 1926 when he was my predecessor as Rawlinson and Bosworth professor. And 1 year into the job, he finished this translation. And 10 years after that, he produced what I think is still the best single work of scholarship on Beowulf, a fantastic lecture called Beowulf, The Monsters and the Critics, to the British Academy. And it's never been bettered.
And why was that? What was so significant about it?
Up to 1936, there was a tendency to regard Beowulf as a sort of repository of lost words or history. There are no Anglo-Saxons in Beowulf. It's about the Danes as much as anything else. And it was mined as a history of Denmark, really. And what Tolkien did, by putting the monsters firmly in the middle, he demonstrated the surprising fact that, listen, it's a poem, it's a work of literature, and it needs to be appreciated as a work of literature, talking about humans and humanity's struggle against forces that we can't perhaps understand and that ultimately will defeat us.
Well, now, you say his lecture was one of the most significant pieces on Beowulf. He wrote this. Why didn't he publish it?
Well, you know, academics aren't very good with deadlines. Maybe 90 years is pushing it. But I think he was a perfectionist. What I find very interesting about this is that it's not, as it were, a first draft that he then stuck in a drawer in 1926 and forgot about. It's been edited by his son, Christopher, who himself is a notable editor of Old Norse material, from 3 different manuscripts. So it's very much like a medieval work. So it's something that he obviously went back to. And the lecture notes that are appended are hugely useful because, as I say, Tolkien was a brilliantly original thinker about Beowulf. And his thoughts are important still today. This is a poem which hasn't dated after 1,000 years. And what Tolkien has to say is fresh and original.
Do you have any part of it there that you can read to us to give us a sense of...
A good example is he describes the death of the dragon and Beowulf and the funeral pyre. And he describes it as, quote, a roaring flame ringed with weeping, which is interesting because lots of those words aren't actually in the Old English. And he's bringing in the idea of ringed with weeping from several other Old English poems. So it's not just a translation of Beowulf. He's bringing in what he knows about Old English literature in general.
And of course, many people now would know Beowulf because of Seamus Heaney and his very celebrated work.
It was an excellent translation. And I think the great thing about Seamus Heaney's translation is you can hear it. There's indeed a BBC audio recording of Seamus Heaney reading Beowulf. And I think that's one of the best and most accessible ways to get to the poem.
Andy Orchard, Anglo-Saxon scholar at Oxford. And here's a snippet of Seamus Heaney's version of Beowulf, read by Heaney.
So times were pleasant for the people there, until finally one, a fiend out of hell, began to work his evil in the world. Grendel was the name of this grim demon, haunting the marches, marauding round the heath and the desolate fens. He had dwelt for a time in misery among the banished monsters, Cain's clan, whom the Creator had outlawed and condemned as outcasts. For the killing of Abel, the Eternal Lord had exacted a price. Cain got no good from committing that murder, because the Almighty made him anathema, and out of the curse of his exile there sprang ogres and elves and evil phantoms, and giants too, who strove with God time and again until he gave them their reward.
Seamus Heaney, reading from his translation of Beowulf. I read the whole thing and I love it. Okay, that's it for today. We have more online, pictures of Bede's monastery, of that nasty pig too, and of a volunteer at Bede's World who's dressed as a monk. Also, either today or tomorrow, we're going to be putting up a fantastic interactive map of the places that I went to on this series of English language evolution. You'll be hearing more about that in the next couple of pods. All of this is at pri.org/language. Otherwise, I'll see you on Facebook at the World in Words page. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is PatryCox. And don't forget to check out some of the other great podcasts at the Soundworks Network. Go to soundworks.org. I'll be back in a mere 24 hours with a Shakespeare pod. See you then. And here's a bit more Geordie now to see us out. Sitting in a sleazy snack bar, sucking sickly sausage rolls.
in a dirty old town on the back of the time, setting my sights on gold. It's plain to see, it's black and white, this Geordie boy's gonna do all right. Gonna make you dance, gonna make you sing, those Geordie boys do anything.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.